This meeting is being sponsored by the FA New England 12-Step Committee for the distinct purpose of creating tapes for the 12-Step Committee tape library. Those who wish, please join me in a moment of silence and the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. There is a seventh tradition, basket, so please be generous. I come from a small town in New Hampshire. I've come here today. It takes about an hour to get here, and I'm mentioning that. I thought of mentioning it because I know that a lot of people who are going to be listening to these tapes live in small towns and live far away from the Boston area where I am right now. And I live there too. We had to start meetings up in this area, and we've grown. I mean, we started small meetings, and now we've grown. We have two meetings in this seacoast area of New Hampshire, where I'm from, and we have three meetings in Maine that are starting, and we're growing. We're really growing, and that's a pretty exciting thing. So I for all of you who are out there, I know what it's like. I thought also that I'd tell you that I'm 53 years old, that I'm about 5'6½", I'm not fat anymore, and I look darn good. By the grace of God, you know, I don't look 53 years old. I look really good. And I'm really happy, and I have a wonderful life, and it's because of this program. And I, you know, you may as well know that, because to a lot of you, I'm invisible. To the people sitting here, they all say, yeah. But to a lot of you, we'll never meet, but you'll just hear a voice, and I thought it'd be good for you to know that it is possible. It is possible. Things really have happened. It wasn't so when I came in. I look a whole lot better now, 13 or 14 years later than when I first came in, because when I first came in, I had turned 40, I had quit smoking, and I was in pure hell, boy. I had started gaining weight at a rate at which I couldn't stop, and I'll talk more about that in a while, but at 40, I was puffy and really fat and getting fatter. I was depressed. I hurt so. Every joint hurt. When I got out of bed in the morning, I would get out of bed and my feet would hurt so much that I couldn't move for 2 or 3 minutes. And that was a real problem because I live where you have to walk pretty far down a horrible old staircase and stuff to get to the bathroom. And I'd have to pee when I'd get up in the morning and I couldn't get there because my feet hurt so much. I couldn't walk. So life was getting bad and I thought, well, you know, I've passed 40. I may as well just admit to being really an old person, an old fat lady, and that's who I'm going to be, boy. And I may as well just give up and that's what life is going to be about. And hey, you know, at 53, I'm a young, thin person, and it's okay. I am who I am. I don't mean I'm young. I just am feeling good and feeling right about being in the world, and that's pretty swell. I think I should probably start at the beginning and give you a little chronology. It's a little easier for me to tell my story that way, and maybe easier to hear it. And I'm always curious where people came from. I was born in 1946, just after the war, and my mother's brother was killed before I was born in the war, and so she was pregnant and grieving and suffering at the same time, and that colored a lot of my childhood. I was named after him, and that's kind of special, and I'm proud to carry that. I was born 2 months prematurely. I weighed 3.5 pounds when I was born. So I was just this tiny little baby, and I had to spend a week or so in an incubator before I could gain enough weight. My first job when I got here, can you imagine this? My first job was to gain weight. I had to gain enough weight to get out of the hospital. That was the first thing I had to do. My mom was really sick during this time. She couldn't nurse, and it was hard. I had none of the nurturing things little teeny babies need. They didn't know how to do things, but you know, I lived. The good news is I'm alive, and I'm not blind or any of the awful things that happened to a lot of premature babies at that time. So I really was given the grace of God right from the beginning. anyway, I grew, and I grew well. I took to this food thing really quickly. By the time I was a thin enough baby, I think, because I really had to make up all of that. But by the time I got to age four, I started chunking out pretty good. You can see I can get to the food. I'm having some self-control over the food now, meaning I can get to the food myself without having to be reliant on someone else to give it to me. And from the time that happens on, boy, I just am at it. My mother, a real moment in my life is when my mother discovered me in the middle of the night in the refrigerator eating cold, plain cold spaghetti. Plain, no sauce, no any of that stuff that makes it bad, just plain cold white noodle. And I was in the middle of the night and she heard this noise and she came in and found me in the refrigerator and she freaked out. She thought I was just gone wrong, boy. She thought there was something really wrong with this kid and took me off to the pediatrician the next morning. And the pediatrician said, well, you know, if she's hungry, let her eat. Well, my mother didn't always concur with that, and it started a struggle. Neither of my parents had a weight problem. My father did briefly, but he controlled it like he did everything else in his life. My father was an orphan. He never was able to go to school. He never had a family. My mother and came up and worked very hard to become a very successful engineer and just very successful. He did very well with his life. My mother came from a farm and worked very hard to get educated and became a very good teacher. In other words, I had a lot to live up to, and there was a lot of pressure. They were very self-motivated, self-willed people who did very well. They were very conservative, very upstanding, always told the truth. My father was a real gentleman. My mother, very gracious lady. They raised me very well. I went to Sunday school and church. I went to school a few years. I got to go to private school because we lived in the country and there weren't too much for the schools. I was given a very good background. We had every single meal together. My father, in spite of being a top executive, was home every night at 6. We had dinner at 6 like clockwork. We always sat at the table. We ate breakfast together. I mean, we didn't have a sort of slapdash kind of thing. I came up from a very controlled eating experience, and I was out of control. I was totally out of control, and they didn't know what to do about it. They thought there was something really wrong with me. They kept taking me to doctors and that kind of thing. They took me to diet doctors. They really thought there was something wrong with me because I just had to have food. And that they couldn't understand. I hated it. I hated being a fat kid. It really, really was hard on me. People called me fatso. They called me chunky. They called me pudgy. Hey, fats. You know, people make kids are really rough on other kids. And I would just curl up in shame. I can remember my stomach just dying in knots when they would call me these things. And I would cry and feel horrible. But would I stop eating? No. That would make me go eat more food. I wanted the food more than I wanted to not eat food. And I did have a pretty good correlation that it was the food that made me fat. I mean, some people don't get that. But my parents began taking me to diet doctors when I was about age 6 or 7. I carried around a calorie counter. I had my own calorie counter that I carried everywhere and tried to figure out how much things how much human calories they had. So I knew that. I guess it was good for my math skills. My father started weighing me every day before I would go to school. I would have to get on the scale and be weighed by my father. That when I was in fifth grade, I think it was, I crossed the mark into being over 100 pounds. And he really, that day was a day of shame for my father, and consequently for me. He said, "Boy, I can see him just sort of shaking his head and saying, we'll never see the other side of that again." And we never did. I kept on going up, and I felt larger than all the kids in my class, and there are many times that I was larger than all the kids in my class. I would have a growth spurt or something like that, and I would be bigger, and I just felt horrible about myself. Once in a while, I'd feel thinner, and that would be okay. I didn't do brilliantly in school. I was smart, And sometimes I would do brilliantly. I would get straight A's, and sometimes I would do very poorly. I was rebellious right from the beginning. I didn't think I needed to do any work. That's actually a large theme in my life, that I thought I didn't have to work. Somehow the great almighty Lynn should have to do everything without working for it. I should be able to get good grades. In fact, I thought that's how people did it. You see, I wasn't born with a real script for life. I wasn't born getting it. I was clueless. I just didn't know how other people managed to live life. I truly didn't know. I didn't know how people got grades. I didn't know how people managed to eat normal amounts. I didn't know how people managed to have a normal sized body. I didn't know how people got to wear those cool clothes so they looked good. I mean, I always looked geeky. I mean, a lot of my life, in my young years, I had, you know, straight hair and braces and socks that slid into my shoes, and I was fat, and I would have sweat under my armpits to die from. I just had, you know, growing up was really hard for me. And I didn't think I had to work. I would do some work if I liked it, but other than that, I thought life was about playing. What I loved most was fantasy. I loved to read, and we got a television when I was about age 8, and I took to that like a duck to water, boy. That had old movies and programs on and stuff like that, and I just thought, yes, this is it. And I learned how to eat in front of the television really quickly, and best, I would suck my thumb, eat, read a book, and watch television. Now, then I was okay. I was safe. I was free from that anxiety, from that horrible kind of icky feeling, scared feeling that I had, that hole inside me, that different feeling that I had. During those times, I would just, you know, be sort of blissed out. I'd be okay. I always call my thumb, by the way, my first drug of choice. I picked it up, I'm sure, as soon as I could get it at me, and I was in high school still trying to break the habit, and I call it drug of choice because I clearly used it to comfort myself, just like I used food later and then other drugs after that. And I used it clandestinely because, again, my parents thought it was horrifying that I would be sucking my thumb. Certainly it was forbidden in school. It was just something you didn't do. So I learned to sneak, to sneak in places, sneak in bed after, you know, people weren't watching me, things like that. So it was the first thing that I learned to do that way. I learned to sneak eat. I mean, at 4 years old, like I said, I was in the refrigerator sneaking, and I learned to eat when my mother couldn't see me. I learned to eat in the middle of the night after school when somebody was in the other room. I learned to eat out of the freezer in the basement or the refrigerator, wherever things were stored. I learned to scoop things from the bottom. I learned to to pick from underneath. I was the queen of the leftover stuff. That was that was how I ate while I was still living with my parents. I had a couple of successful diets, one after eighth grade and one after high school. In each of those cases, I managed to get thin right in time to graduate. I held it enough to start the next year in the new place, in the new high school, and then again in the new college. And so I started each of those things thin, but then I, you know, betrayed everybody quite quickly by getting fat, going back to my normal stuff. And that's how it went. I simply couldn't control it. But I had those two times, and it's clear to me that I was trying to control my life and control my weight, and thought if I were just thin, then everything would be okay. And had the rude awakening that we all get, that thin is not okay. You know, thin gave me this sense of glamour, and I thought I could, you know, if everything looked all right on the outside, remember that I'm the one who didn't know how to be on the inside. I had no internal being. I just thought if I could get that outside looking right, that everything would be okay. You know, if I had the right clothes, the right face, the right place, the right whatever, the right body, I'd be okay. And it just never worked that way. And of course then, since it wasn't working that way, I had to eat again to get things right. So, that's how that went. My parents took me to a series of doctors, and among them what they took me to was a psychiatrist. I was in psychoanalysis at age 12 through age 16. That meant that every day after school, my mother came in and drove me to the city to the analyst. That's a pretty weird thing to do to a kid. And what I guess I'm going to say is maybe it helped. I'm trying to look back and forgive it and understand, but it gave me this feeling of being just totally unique, that there was something really, really deeply wrong with me, that I was sick in some horrible kind of way that other people couldn't see, that I was defective, just all kinds of things. Also, after it was over, I think it also made me feel that I was totally healed, totally recovered, and totally powerful, and I didn't know what to do with all the feelings of anxiety and, messes that I got myself into after I got into college and stuff. I thought I was supposedly healed, that I knew the way, that other people didn't know the way. I thought that I had been given that through all that torturous treatment, and I hadn't. I got into college. I went to art school. It was the 60s. And I picked up the grown-up drugs. I picked up cigarettes first. I went to college at age 17. And the first thing I picked up was cigarettes. And I was at art school in Boston. And I wanted to be cool. There's just no two ways about it. I picked up cool. Cool for me was a drug. If I could be cool, then I could be safe. Remember, I wanted to get that outside right. So being cool got it really right, because if you were cool, it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. I was playing by my own rules then. I was playing by, the rules of people who accepted me. I was accepted. And the cooler I could get, the more accepted by the out there people I was. Therefore, it didn't matter what all the straight people were doing. It was just, I was all right. And so I picked up alcohol at that time, I'm totally an addict. I am totally, utterly an addict. When I pick up anything, I do more of it. I have a real good friend whose name is Maura, and she always said, they named me Maura because I always wanted Maura everything. And that's exactly who I am. I always wanted Maura. When I had my first drink, I didn't get drunk on the first drink. I got drunk on the seven drinks I drank that time. I had a boyfriend break up with me, and I had him buy me a pint of whiskey. This is, 1 month into college. I'm already going right after it. I started using drugs, and I didn't just use drugs, I sold them. Everybody didn't do that. Not everybody who has a drink in college immediately decides to become a drinker. Not everybody who has, cigarettes immediately starts smoking Gauloises and Pall Malls and, strong cigarette Camels, strong cigarettes to be cool. I did pot, and I thought it was great. I'd sell it, boy. I thought that stuff was really terrific. I started hanging out with, druggies and going to heavy parties and doing all these kind of things. Inside I'm also, here I am, this sweet little apple-cheeked, Susie cream cheese kind of girl who really, wasn't meaning to do all of this. So what a conflict. I mean, I didn't have the soul of a drunkard or the soul of a whatever. I up until that time I'd been a peace marcher and a freedom marcher and cared deeply about making the world a better place. I mean, that's what I did all through high school. And I got to college and found all of this stuff, and boy, I went nuts. It's funny because I'm an historian now, and I think the historical perspective is kind of fascinating to realize where I was. That was 1964, and things started moving. By 1967, 68, the whole world was falling apart, and I went right along with it. Boy. 1968 was a terrible year for me. Between Martin Luther King's assassination and Bobby Kennedy's assassination, I had a really fairly major sort of what my analyst called a manifestation of phobias and what most people would call a nervous breakdown. In those days, they didn't give you Prozac. It hadn't been invented yet. They didn't give you any of that. They just gave you more therapy. So I did a lot of therapy and managed to come through it. But I felt like the whole world was crazy. During that time, I didn't understand what had happened. I didn't understand the lyrics to all the songs. I used to pretend I did. I did all the coolest stuff, and I hung out with the coolest people, and my friends had pretty heavy rock bands, and a lot of them are pretty out there today. The ones that aren't dead, they're still kind of out there. We were out on the line, and historically, it's interesting because mine was sort of the first year that was happening. It was, there were people coming along after, who got to watch us, but for us, we were the first. I always felt like I was on the tip of the wave coming in on a surfboard, and I didn't know what was coming in front of me. I was just going to hit that beach, and I didn't know how to do it. Things were the whole world was happening under my feet, and I didn't know how to do it. So naturally, I was seeking for comfort in all of this, and I was eating and drugging and cigaretting and doing all of those things and going crazy. And I got through college somehow. I dropped out. I went back in. I made it up. I got realized I got to get going here. I moved into adulthood out of college, not knowing, again, not having a clue how to get to things. I spent my 20s moving around the country trying for what I now call a geographic cure, thinking if I could just find a new place, a new job, a new thing, again, I'd get it right. I'd get that outside picture right, and somehow I'd be right. But I wasn't. And I was on a constant series of diets. I was, because I was smoking so much, I was able to keep my weight at about 20 pounds, roughly 20, 25 pounds over. I would sometimes diet down and be thin for a while, and then I'd go back up and then I'd diet down. So I was sort of, I guess they call it yo-yo dieting during that time, controlling it. I was controlling it. That's what I did basically through my 20s and into my 30s. And then I picked up another addiction. When I moved to New Hampshire, I landed in New Hampshire after all that, and I picked up work as an addiction. Who'd think? The person who thought she had to get everything easy. I did discover in college that if I worked, I could get good grades. And thank you God, I got to do that so that I ended up graduating, from an Ivy League university, with A's. And that was pretty amazing. So I learned I could do something at that stage. I guess that analyst did help me some. And I need to be grateful for the things that did come through there. But I hit my 30s and I hit New Hampshire and I picked up a job, I picked up a career, and I went for it like it was what I was a drowning person. And I worked then, 60-hour weeks were routine. When I finally left the job 5 years later, I had like 5 months of overtime built up they had to pay me for. So I started my own business with salary still coming in for 5 months. I thought I was cool. I mean, what does that say? I was proud that I hadn't taken a vacation. I was proud that I'd done all of this. I had a cartoon pasted on my file cabinet that showed that I was, it shows the people at a cocktail party with this little explosion in their midst, and it says, hey, there goes another dynamite person. And I thought that was what was going to happen to me. I really thought I was going to self-destruct, and I didn't know how. I would read all these magazines that would say, okay, meditate, diet, run, do all these things to fix yourself, and I'd think, that's it. All right, tomorrow morning I'm going to get up, and I'm gonna eat right. I'm gonna eat bean sprouts and tofu, and I'm gonna, and I'm gonna run, and I'm gonna not smoke, and I'm not gonna drink, and I'm not gonna do any of this stuff. I'm gonna meditate, and I'm gonna be, by 10 o'clock I was smoking and, drinking coffee and right back at it again. I couldn't do that any more than I could fly. So I could feel myself having heart palpitations. I'd walk a block and I'd have to stop three times because my heart would be palpating and stuff. I was getting worse and worse and worse is what I'm getting at. I had boyfriend after boyfriend. I always wanted nothing more than to get married. I was an only child. I came from this, tense family of older parents. And I wanted nothing more than to get married and have, 17 children and the screen door slapping with cows and dogs and chickens running here, there, and everywhere. And I couldn't make it happen. I just couldn't make it happen. Every time I met someone, I thought, I'm in love, this is it. And it wasn't. Time after time, I would just bomb again. So that was a really major part of my life. And here I was getting older and older and still single. I was engaged 5 times at that point. I would get engaged and it would just bomb. How did I know how to be with another person? I didn't have a clue who I was. I didn't know how to be with me. I didn't know. And besides, I was very tied to my parents, who were getting very much older at this point, and the responsibilities for them were getting stronger and stronger. And one of the things I got through not from this disease taking away my ability to have a family, to have my own family, to go on and make a successful marriage, I did get a stronger relationship with my parents. With my family of origin, I had a much stronger, I was able to be there for them as they got old and able to be there for each of them as they died. And I'm very grateful that I had that relationship and that took me through. My mother died now, 5 years ago. I was so glad that I could be there, that I could show up for her and really be in profound relationship with her at the end of her life. And that was something special. And I'll jump ahead now and tell you that what God has given me through really being willing to turn my life over to God completely, from being willing to embrace my singleness, being willing to embrace that part that came into my life and saying, God, if it is your will for me to be single, then let me be single and let me be alive and with you and in a good relationship with you, God. By being willing to be there, actually, amazingly, God has given me a wonderful man in my life, and I have a wonderful relationship, and I'm engaged and getting married at 53 years old. Not bad, huh? God gives you amazing things. I had stopped looking for it, didn't even want it, and God brought it into my life. And it's wonderful, and it's even pretty easy. Where was I? I was getting through my 20s and 30s and my work addiction and my 40s and getting and feeling horrible. I turned 40 and I was in this monster mess that I described at the beginning. And I did manage to quit smoking, and that took the lid off. I see my life as this kind of compound set of addictions, alcohol and so on and so on. And when I put the first one down, which was nicotine, all hell broke loose with the other ones, particularly the food addiction. And I started getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and I couldn't go on a diet. I had always been able to go on some sort of a diet, keep some sort of lid on it, and now I couldn't. I felt like Lucille Ball. She was cooking pots of, I suppose it was rice or something, but it just kept exploding. The lids kept going all over the room. That's what my life felt like this just runaway, exploding, boiling over mess, and I couldn't stop eating. I suddenly realized that I was eating around the clock in the middle of the night. I mean, all my sneak eating was, just out of control. I was carrying food with me wherever I went. I was carrying food in my briefcase when I went to meetings. I was carrying, not this kind of meeting, okay, business meetings. I had food in the car when I would go to stay overnight with people. That was torture for me. I would pack my suitcase with food so that I could go to my room. I could eat, like a normal person sitting at the table with them, and then I'd go upstairs and eat. I thought of only where the food was coming from. All my life I've been obsessed with food and cared about food more than anything. I mean, I just never was normal around food. But now I really had the horrifying realization that I couldn't stop eating. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I absolutely didn't know. I was in therapy at this time. I was in group therapy and individual therapy, and I couldn't stop eating. I would go out and buy great masses of food and then eat behind the grocery store, behind the fast food place, wherever it was, and eat behind the dumpster so I could throw away all the evidence. I tried being bulimic. I tried really hard to throw up, and all I got from my troubles was blood all over the floor. I had a terrible bloody nose, and my eyes turned the color of blood. I mean, I broke all the blood vessels in both eyes. And so that kind of put me off being bulimic, although I sure wished I could pull it off. I couldn't. So there I was stuck. I was stuck retaining all the stuff I ate. And I tried exercise, and I couldn't possibly exercise to keep up anything like with what I was putting in. I just was stuck. There was just seemed to be nothing I could do. And I knew better than to go to Weight Watchers and all these things. I knew if I couldn't go on a diet. I know that anybody could give me any diet, any doctor, anybody anywhere could give me a diet, and I knew I couldn't follow it any more than fly. I just couldn't do it. So what happened is there were people in my therapy group that were in AA, and I heard them, and I listened to them, and I'd quit smoking, and I talked to them, and suddenly I remembered from the dusty dark ages long ago hearing a comedian on television saying that he'd found this new thing, and that was called OA, that they got together and they talked. Remember, this is 14 years ago. And they talked together between meetings, and they realized they had a different kind of problem with food. And I thought, what about going to this 12-step thing? What about this? So 14 years ago, I went to my first 12-step meeting, and at that meeting, the person who was qualifying was talking about how she controlled her food was with, she was doing this Jeanine Roth thing that she had to decide what she really wanted, something sweet, something salty, something creamy, and then she'd just decide what she really wanted and she'd have that. That was what the person qualifying was saying. Well, despite that, I heard something different. I heard something different in that meeting, because I thought, I don't think that would work for me, but I listened. And that wasn't what I took away from that meeting, though. What I took away from the meeting was the 12 steps. I took away a big book. I took away the Serenity Prayer. I took away, those thoughts. I took away the thought that I might have a really sincere problem with this. And I began going to that 12-step meeting, and slowly I got into Al-Anon because I was dating an alcoholic at that time. I then discovered my own troubles with alcohol and began going to AA. So I was going to OA, AA, and Al-Anon. And I did that for about 6 years. I went to at least 7 meetings a week, sometimes many times more. And my life began to change. I had the my first spiritual experience, and I had the hope of forming a relationship with God. I didn't have any relationship with God when I first came in. I simply couldn't. I just didn't know. I was cynical old 60s girl. You know, God was the opiate of the masses, and that sure wasn't going to work for this girl. But then I thought, well, the people who are successful here, and the whole basis of the program seems to be a spiritual foundation. And if you're only working the mental and the physical here, you know, you're still missing something. You really, you know, this is a direction I need to go in. So I talked to myself and got willing to keep an open mind. And I began asking people, you know, what is this God thing? What is all this about? And I kept open, and I began to be willing to follow suggestions. You know, this is a program of action, and I followed the suggestions. I got on my knees and I asked God for help. And when I was in paralyzing trouble, paralyzingly terrified of a situation that I was in, I got on my knees and I said, I don't know who you are or what you are or what this God thing is, but other people believe and I want to believe. And I guess I do believe that there is something out there that is greater than myself, because I can't run my life and I can't run this universe, and something else seems to make the whole universe go in good ways, and I can't do it. And I am in so much trouble, God. Oh, please help me. Just please, please, please help me. I don't know what to do. And I know that I don't even know what to ask you to how to decide this situation, but please help me. And when I really cried that time, I really cried from the depths of my soul, this incredible peace came into me and spread through my whole being. And I stayed there on my knees with this incredible warm peacefulness, and finally I thought, well, what is this stuff? And I was afraid to stop it, so I just stayed on my knees and stayed on my knees, and then I gradually snuck into bed, and I snuck into bed and went right to sleep, which was amazing. And when I woke up in the morning, this feeling, that incredible peaceful feeling, was still all over me. And I had this song in my head that I remembered from summer camp, and it's Rock of My Soul in the Bosom of Abraham. And it says, it's so high you can't get over it, so low you can't get under it, so wide you can't get around it, oh Rock of My Soul. And I just love it. I mean, the love that was in me was there, and I thought, I think I've had a spiritual experience. I think this is real. I think this spiritual thing must be real. Oh, my word. To the old cynic, this real spiritual thing had happened. Not looking for it, not expecting it, not really believing it. And there it had come, totally unbidden. And so I had no choice but to believe. And I have had other experiences like that that have just made me know, holy, holy, holy true, that it is real. God is real. It's really real. So I came in willing to do that. But that didn't carry me forever. All of this good knowledge of God and going to all these meetings, it didn't carry me, because I was in a program that said abstinence is self-defined. And I didn't really have a sponsor. I didn't really have anybody telling me how to do things. And so I did it my way, naturally. I mean, I'm a self-willed addict artist, and I did it my way. And it helped me. I managed to maintain a pretty fair weight loss, a pretty regular kind of thing, for about 3 or 4 years. But you know, the going got rough. My father died, and I picked up an abusive relationship right after my father died, and I got a horrible ulcer in my stomach and eventually ate a hole all the way through into my intestine. And I picked up this awful, horrible, abusive relationship, which didn't help the ulcer much. And I began nibbling because of the ulcer, because the eating made it feel better. And I didn't really have this thing. So I began people pleasing with the food, trying to solve the abusive relationship with food. Ha ha. And before you know it, I'd gained 35 pounds. I couldn't even use the relapse word at that point. It took me almost a year before I could really use the relapse word. But I was I was in total relapse. I was still trying to eat three meals a day. I was eating brown flour, saying that I wasn't eating flour and sugar. Ho ho. And I was in a mess. All my misery and despair had been refunded, just like they say it will be. I was thinking then, well, what do I need? Maybe I need to go to a rehab. Maybe I need to, maybe I need to go to therapy again. Therapy, me, who had a bazillion years of therapy and it never worked, you know. I'm thinking of all these things that I already know won't work. Do I think of get a sponsor, get abstinent? Well, you know, I had to tell you that I didn't have that model out in front of me. There weren't people that were abstinent. There weren't people with sponsors in meetings. That wasn't happening where I was going to meetings. And but then I was at an AA meeting, and I saw somebody that had been going to food meetings with me, and she was thin, and she had, better than even being thin, she had clear eyes. She had this absolutely beautiful, radiant smile. And I looked at her, and I thought, oh, my word, she's got something different. So I went zooming over to her at the break and said, hey, what are you doing? And she said, well, you know, I'm a really low bottom, a really gutter food addict. And I have to go to these really hard-nosed meetings down in Boston, down in Chelsea, Massachusetts. And I went, oh, yeah, right, okay. With those, you know, the people who, who weigh and measure and don't eat no matter what they don't eat, you know, with those people, all those uptight people, you know, we don't do that, do you? And she said, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I said, well, I'll see you. But, you know, 2 weeks later, I was driving home from a business meeting in Boston, stopping at every fast food restaurant, and I was crying and miserable, and I called her. And she said, I can't help you, but here's the number of someone who can. And I called this person, and this sight unseen, and I was crying, and I said, I'm in relapse. Can you help me? Can you possibly help me? And she said, sure. And she gave me a food plan. She said, I'll meet you in 45 minutes. We're going to the meeting. She took me to a meeting. She gave me a list of people to call. She said, call me tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. And just don't eat. And I went home and went, okay, I'm not going to eat. I am not going to eat no matter what. I am not going to eat. I am not going to eat. I'm going to go through this night and I'm not going to eat. And I got on my knees and I said, God, please help me through this night, just tonight, until I can call her tomorrow morning. Please help me through this night. And I was terrified. I got on my knees and I asked for help, and I got in bed and I slept like a baby, and I woke up and the sun was shining, and I got on the phone and she said, how are you? And I said, I'm abstinent. And she said, thank you, God. And we started every conversation like that, for a month. And, you know, thank you, God, that was 6 years and 90 days ago today, this very day. Because I got my first 90 days on Thanksgiving Day, and today is 90 days. And I, at that moment, said, I'm going through. I am going to be a winner. I am not going to pick up. I started going to meetings where people were abstinent and had been abstinent for a long time. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. Things I couldn't imagine. People who had lost hundreds of pounds. I mean, I would be in a room for all of you out there in the boondocks. I am in rooms now where there are 100 people. And of these 100 people, so many of them have lost so much weight, hundreds of pounds. I sponsor someone now who has lost over 200 pounds. And she's kept it off for 9 years. Can you believe that? 9 years. This is such an amazing program. And I would watch this and I thought, I am going through. I want to be one of those winners. And it's not just that they were thin, or that they are thin. It's that they have clear eyes. And, you know, clear eyes that meet you right straight dead on, and clear souls smiling right out of those faces. And I thought, I want to be one of those people. I want to have that abstinent glow, that abstinent smile. So I'm going through. God, help me. You go with me, God, and I'll just do whatever it takes. If I have to be hungry, I'll be hungry. And during that time, it was really hard. During my first 90 days, I had to sell my mom's house. Oh, scary. I had moved my mother into another nursing home. I had to I had that hole in my stomach was just killing me. I was doubled over in pain, but I still, the doctor would say, eat it. I'd say, I'm sorry, I'm eating three meals a day and that's it. Work with me, okay? And he worked with me, they worked with me, and I got through. And I had really low energy, and I got through that. I had to give up going to the gym for a while during that time because I was tired from the withdrawal after all those years, thinking I was not in relapse, and I had horrible withdrawal. I mean, it's not easy going through that first period. When you first get abstinent, it's not easy, but you know it's worth it, because you get to that other side, and oh boy, your life is so different. I started my first AWOL, and I'm now in the middle of my fourth, and thank you, God, I am now leading an AWOL. I'm co-leading an AWOL in New Hampshire. We close next week, and we have 25 people almost that are coming, and that is such a miracle. Ah, it is such a gift from God. I have just experienced the most wonderful things, most of the most wonderful things. I mean, first of all, there's the physical recovery. And that, like I said, is pretty cool. I wear a size 6 now, absolutely, unless I have to pick up a size 4 because the sizes are weird or something like that, you know. But it's not about that. It's not about that. It's wonderful to, I have a pair of pants on today that I bought 3 years ago. I didn't even think about it. I just got them out of the closet and put them on. Back in the old days, I could no more do that. I had all these bizarre sizes. I would be pouring myself into things, struggling with stuff around my waist, struggling to get things on, my thighs rubbing and chafing. I suffered all the agony. When I first came in, I was wearing, you know, sort of moo-moo tents, things that were held together with safety pins that I couldn't sew. If I got one outfit, man, I clung to it. You know, I had these kind of wild hippie outfits that were just so I could be dramatic and maybe you wouldn't notice. If I were dramatic enough, you wouldn't notice the fat. And so I would, you know, go through all of that. So putting on, you know, just a pair of pants that I had on 3 years ago is a miracle. They happen to be velvet, so I don't wear them every day. Otherwise, they'd be worn out. I just want you to know this works that way. I could put on these clothes. So that's the physical recovery. I feel better, by the way. My doctors think I'm a working marvel. My gum disease, I take care of it. And because of this program, you know, I'm not losing all my teeth. Isn't that neat? I can't say my vision is necessarily better, or my memory, but all sorts of other parts are getting better. At 53, you have to go, you know, things start going. But you can weather all that kind of stuff, you know. It's not so bad. The mental recovery, mental emotional recovery is amazing. I was always oversensitive. All my life I cried and cried and cried, and my job in the family was to feel everybody's feelings. I came from a family that just didn't show their feelings, that were really cold and superficial and I wanted to be from an ethnic family, from a family that, you know, hugged and loved and, you know, ate. But anyway, all of that kind of stuff. And I came from these kind of cold wasp, parents who would pat me on the head or something, but God forbid they would hug me. So I didn't have much of that kind of thing, and I wanted it desperately. And so there wasn't much feeling, not much emotion in the family, and my job was to have feelings. So I outfelt everybody. I mean, I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried. And through my first AWOL, I sobbed so that people thought they would need a boat, you know, to get through AWOL. It was terrible. But all this stuff came pouring out of me. For all that therapy, I thought that I would be okay, and I had so much of me to discover. As I get to know me, by the way, I like me better and better and better. I mean, Lynn is pretty worth knowing, and it's pretty nice. I have come to a good relationship with God, a good relationship with me, and it's just wonderful. I wanted to say that one of the important moments of my growth in the last couple of years has been when my sponsor said, you know, Lynn, it's time to stop crying. It's really time to put down all that sensitivity and all those tears. You know, people who have recovery in this program don't cry as much as you do. And I thought she was nuts. I was real angry. And then I listened. That's the way I always treated words from my sponsor. I sometimes they're hard for me to hear because I'm kind of allergic to criticism, but I listen to them and I learn. And if I'm willing, and that's what this whole program is about, being honest, open, and willing. If I'm willing to take her suggestions, willing to follow the suggestions of the people who have gone before me in this program, it never lets me down. It never fails. My life changes. And so suddenly, miraculously, I was delivered from this sea of tears. I don't mean I never cry. It's just life is balance, an emotional balance. And spiritually, I have a wonderful relationship with a higher power I choose to call God. I have a wonderful relationship with the community I live in. I really believe in community. I believe in the importance of, I edit my town newspaper. I'm very involved in all parts of my life. I have a wonderful new family. It's Thanksgiving today, and I who have no family left on the planet but two half-sisters who live out in California, have a wonderful new family that I'm marrying into. I get to go there for Thanksgiving, where there'll be all kinds of siblings, hey, you know, a mother and father and sisters and nieces and nephews and all kinds of people that are taking me into their family. It's the thing I always dreamed of. I wanted to come from a big family, and at 50 years, 3 years old, I'm getting to be part of it. It's an absolute miracle, and I am so grateful to God for bringing me into that place. And I know each day that it is because of my abstinence and because of this working this program and the program that we now call FA. Because of FA, I learned the structure I needed. FA gives me a strong definition of abstinence, a strong sponsor relationship, a strong meeting relationship. I go to committed meetings. I read my 24-hour book every day. I read my big book at night, and I pray, and I have quiet time that I've learned to take so that I can sit quietly with myself. And I work the tools of this program to the best of my ability, which I am not going to stand here and ever tell anybody I am perfect, but to the best of my ability on a daily basis, one day at a time, I work this program. And I am grateful that we have been given the clarity and structure that we have been given, because that is what I need. I need to run my life as an addict. I will run myself. Running myself, I can't. And I need to turn my life over to God and to use this structure. The structure of this program is the 1% I can bring. God gives me all the rest. And I am deeply grateful this day to have been here to participate in this program. I wish everyone who hears this tape good abstinence and good day, and know that it works. Just please know that I believe that it works. It has worked in my life, and if it worked for me, it can work for you. Will all those who wish please join me in a moment of silence in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.